I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Small earthquakes rumbled across Southeast Asia today, reaching 6.1 on the Richter scale, compared to the massive 9.0 earthquake that set off this weekend's tsunamis. And today's quakes set off warnings in several countries of a new tsunami. The fears proved unfounded, but in Thailand, panicky crowds fled inland to the sound of sirens, and in India, government warnings of a new surge also sent aid workers running, but India's Minister of Science and Technology, Kapil Sibal, later called it a false alarm.
I'm afraid that whoever has given this alert has unnecessarily created a sense of panic.
Meanwhile, the death toll climbs and climbs. The latest estimates, 118,000 dead and rising. Emergency teams have yet to arrive in many of the remote areas in Indian Ocean nations, thought to have suffered even worse damage than those already seen all this week. And one foreign minister said yesterday that the disaster was likely to be his nation's worst in modern times. Well, that nation is Norway. Among the tens of thousands killed by the tsunami, some 6,000 European tourists, whose names are on airline passenger manifests and in consulate records across Asia, are still missing. Europe is bracing for the final tally. And joining us from Berlin is Judy Dempsey. She's senior correspondent for the International Herald Tribune. Welcome, Judy.
Thank you very much.
And tell us, what are some of the numbers?
The numbers keep rising, and the real difficulty, of course, is confirming them. But at the moment, according to the German authorities, particularly the foreign ministry, they're now approaching the 1,000 mark. Chancellor Gerhard Schröder of Germany gave a news conference yesterday, said that at least they run into triple figures, but in fact, they may be over 1,000. The greatest casualty figures seems to be from Norway and Sweden. They could run into perhaps 2,000. Again, many are missing, but the longer they are missing, the fears from these countries is that they will have died in the earthquake.
And we should say U.S. officials are saying that there may be 2,000 to 3,000 Americans who are missing and unaccounted for. But why are Germany and Scandinavia especially hard hit?
It's a really important question. The winters are very, very long in Norway, in Sweden, in Scandinavia. And in Germany, too, they're long, they're dark, and the spring comes rather late, particularly to the eastern part of Germany. And so the immediate reflex for years has been, once the Germans got tired, really, of southern Spain, the Canary Islands, they discovered Thailand, they discovered Southeast Asia, with the long, sultry, sunshine evenings and the lovely beaches, and they just go there. The Christmas period was a magnet for the Scandinavians and the Germans, and that's where they were when the earthquake hit.
And we understand that many of the tourists who survived are streaming back into Europe's airports, and that the coverage there has been extraordinary. This is not that they're comparable in other ways, but this is in some ways Europe's 9/11. Is that an accurate description of how they're reacting?
I wouldn't call it a 9/11. There is this perception that, you know, the more the well-off country is, the more you can just get onto a flight and go far away and be safe. And I think the shock now is to these tourists is that it happened to them. And somehow there's a perception, part of the perception in the media at least, is, oh, well, the infrastructure wasn't good enough and the hospital care wasn't good enough and the early reaction should have been much better. But in fact, somehow it never got into the consciousness that anything could happen. So, you see, Europe has been so obsessed with 9/11 from the American perspective, the terrorism, the problems of the Middle East, the problems of Iraq, and so they wanted to sort of put this out of their minds, do tourism, and tourism, you're safe. Mm. There's just one other tiny point, especially with the bombings in Tabor down in southern Egypt. Of course, this affected tourism, and even more, Southeast Asia became a magnet for the Europeans.
Well, we know some extraordinary things have happened. In Sweden, cell companies text messaged everyone who had a cell phone in the area saying to please call home. They sent airplanes. Gerhard Schröder canceled his vacation, but in the few seconds we have left, and just a few seconds, there have been complaints. Norwegians, for instance, say Sweden helped them more than their own government. There's been some friction.
There's always friction, and some political parties will make mileage out of this. But in general, particularly in Germany, nobody's tried to make mileage. They want to get the people home. They want to find out who's been missing. And generally, despite some carping, I think the public is right behind the government now.
Judy Dempsey, senior correspondent for the International Herald Tribune. She's speaking to us from Berlin. Judy, thanks very much.
Pleasure.
Last fall, a dozen or so Muslim intellectuals gathered in Cairo for a seminar entitled Islam and Reform. Some scholars called for minor adjustments, but one in particular called for a wholesale rewriting of the religion, a Protestant-like reformation for Muslims, prompting religious conservatives to lunge at the podium shouting, liar, infidel, Zionist. Mohammed Shakrour, a Syrian engineer, has been called the Muslim Martin Luther because of his calls for reform. He joins us now from Damascus. Dr. Shakrour, welcome.
Good afternoon.
What do you mean by reform? As you know, Martin Luther broke from the Catholic Church, a huge transition. What do you mean by reform in Islam?
Exactly. I mean, when Martin Luther began his reform, he began with the following phrase, Scripture is its own interpreter. This is what Martin Luther said.
Mm-hmm.
I am saying Quran is its own interpreter. I assume that Prophet Muhammad died and he left this Quran to us to read it and to apply it, to understand it now. And this is what I have done from 1967 by now. For 37 years now I am working on that.
Martin Luther said that Christ was the sole mediator between God and man, and that God is the only one who can give forgiveness, and is in essence saying that the hierarchy of the Catholic Church was not necessary. Are you saying that the hierarchy of the Muslim faith, the clerics, are not necessary?
I am saying that we need 10 commandments for society and state, 10 commandments only. We don't need fatwa. We need parliaments, not fatwa. The era of fatwa has elapsed. We need election and parliament.
You're also calling for a different interpretation of the Quran, especially the violent passages. Tell us about that.
This is what I want to tell you. All the terminology of violence, this is very important to understand for the Western listener, was under the oppressive rulers of 12 centuries ago. The principle of violence, what we call jihad, was formulated in 12 centuries ago, when was the Islamic State a very strong one, and under, and the state was very oppressive. And at that time, was everything was divided into infidel house and Islamic house.
Are you saying then that the violence that some might see in the Quran and some might use now in carrying out suicide bombings, etc., that that's something that only belongs in historical context?
Of course.
Dr. Shakrour, as you know, there are many clerics who would be outraged at what you're saying.
Yes, I know that.
Do you fear for your own life?
In Syria, no, I don't fear. Outside Syria, yes. Because in Syria, there is strong regime and very safe and more or less secular regime. Therefore, it's not dangerous in Syria.
Are there any fatwas against you?
Yes. Publicly, I don't go anywhere publicly because it will be dangerous.
Do you get any support from Muslims?
From intellectual, yes, and from young. For instance, in Indonesia, I have many, many supporters because all my books has been translated into Indonesian language and in Malaysia as well. And I have many supporters in all Arabic countries, especially in Saudi Arabia.
Do you think there can ever come a time when fundamentalist Muslims and moderate Muslims can coexist in the way that Christians coexist, even though, for instance, in the USA, there are fundamentalist Christians?
It needs long time to fulfill this goal.
Do you aspire to form a breakaway form of Muslim, the Muslim faith, much as Martin Luther formed Protestantism?
Yes. Why they hate me so much? Because I have put the alternative. And therefore, I have made a challenge till now to oppose me in television, to meet me.
You've challenged them to a debate on television. Do you think they will respond?
No. No, they will not. Because they know that I'm talking sense.
Dr. Shakrour, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, we turn now to Gabriel Saeed Reynolds. He's a professor of theology at Notre Dame. And I want your response to what we've been hearing about Dr. Shakrour, his theories of, like Martin Luther King, asking the Muslim faith to think of splitting from any kind of hierarchy, first of all. How is that likely to be received?
Right. What he's speaking about is having the freedom to come up with new interpretations, and that means especially new interpretations of law. Islam, of course, unlike other religions, considers itself to have universal application. Yeah, it's not only to pray or for the spiritual growth, but it's for all aspects of life. At the beginning of the 10th century, Islamic law was, for all effect and purposes, closed off. And in fact, there's a term used by Muslims to say the gate, and here's an Arabic word, of ijtihad, which usually means rational interpretation, was closed. The gate was shut. And from that point on, from the beginning of the 10th century till today, the job of the Muslim intellectual is to interpret and apply only according to the four traditional schools of thought, and I won't get into that. So what he's saying is, can we open that gate again? Can we go around these four traditional schools and come up with new ways of formulating Islamic law?
Wouldn't his life be in danger for even suggesting this?
We certainly have plenty of precedents of scholars who have proposed similar theories and have, in fact, been in danger from it. Perhaps the most famous case in the Islamic world, and this is not well known in the West, but was an Iraqi author in the 1930s. In fact, a famous poet, well respected for his poetry, by the name of Ma'ruf al-Safi, in fact from Fallujah. And in the 1930s, he wrote a book about the Prophet's life called The Muhammadan Personality, or The Personality of Muhammad. And this is back in the 1930s. He was so afraid to publish this that he never did. He kept it. Not only that, he was afraid for his family's welfare, so he put it in his will that the book would not be published for 40 years after his death. In fact, it was published finally in the 1990s. There are some other cases, of course. Just a year ago, in late 2003, a Pakistani scholar by the name of Yunus Sheikh, who made some comments about the way that the Quran was revealed, also happened to add that, well, we have to accept that the Prophet's parents weren't Muslim, because it was the Prophet to whom Islam was revealed, and that also means that the Prophet wasn't circumcised. So even these sort of comments, which traditionally Muslims would accept logically, got him into trouble, and he was, in fact, sentenced to death for blasphemy, and last year, a year ago, released. So indeed, it can be a sensitive and at times dangerous topic.
Gabriel Saeed Reynolds, professor of theology at Notre Dame. When we come back, we're going to continue our look at attempts of reform in the Islamic faith, including scholarly reinterpretations of the Quran, the holy scriptures of Islam. One scholar suggesting that martyrs aren't greeted in heaven by virgins, but rather by pure white grapes. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Returning to our conversation about attempts at reform in the Muslim faith, we spoke earlier with Syrian scholar Muhammad Shahroor, who has called for a Martin Luther-like reformation in Islam. And we're joined again by Gabriel Saeed Reynolds. He's professor of theology at the University of Notre Dame. And Gabriel, you were saying that Islamic scholars like Shahroor have faced personal danger for expressing controversial new ideas. We want to add, of course, parallels exist in Christianity and other traditions, the persecution of Galileo, the Spanish Inquisition, but today we are talking about Islam. And one of the most controversial issues is the reinterpretation of the Holy Quran. As you well know, Gabriel, the 9/11 terrorists believe that they would be met at the gates of heaven by 47 virgins. Some researchers have since said no. Actually, that word isn't virgins, it's grapes.
Yes, indeed. Not virgins, but grapes. This is, of course, the most recent and perhaps most controversial Quranic theory made by an author who gives us only his pseudonym, Christoph Luxemburg, and apparently he's a scholar in Germany. He argues that the Quran was the first Arabic book. When the book was written, it was written with great help from the language that was the religious language even of the Arabs, which was Aramaic or Syriac. So what happened is in the Quran we have this mixed language. It's not pure Arabic. However, when the first interpretations were written, they worked on the basis of Arabic, of pure Arabic. So you got this gap, such as this idea of virgins, and the word for that in the Quran is hur, which is not a pure Arabic word, but based on the context, it said, well, this must be virgins. Luxembourg goes and says, wait, can we go back to Aramaic here? Can we see that, in fact, there is a perfectly good Aramaic word here, which means not virgin, but white, simply white. And then if we look at other imagery for paradise from the time, it was always the white grapes that were the pearls of paradise. So he says, if we can do this and discover the original mixed language of the Quran, then we can really get to it. We can get to the real Quran. And not only that, we'll be happy to discover that many of the new meanings we uncover are in fact more, let's say, acceptable to a modern audience. That is, there's less focus on violence or less focus on the sensual imagery of paradise.
How much also does it strike at the heart of a Muslim to hear about perhaps softening the violence in the Quran? I've heard Christians say, well, at least, yes, there's violence in the Bible, but it's never spoken by Jesus Christ.
Right.
Whereas in the Quran, some of the violence is spoken by Muhammad. Now, you tell me, is that true? And is that a big difference for Muslims, that to change that would be to change the words spoken by the Prophet?
Right. Dr. Shahroor himself likes to comment on chapter 9, which is called the chapter of the repentance, Surat al-Tawbah, in which there's a special concentration of revelation on military action, the relation of Muslims and non-Muslims.
This is when there was a push to form a state on the Arabian Peninsula?
This is, right, Dr. Shahroor's interpretation. Mm-hmm. And now what he does, which is novel, and this is where he kind of ventures to the frontiers of interpretation, is he says, listen, this is not only about interpreting or understanding these passages in a different way. This is about relevance, that the ultimate importance of the Quran is not to legislate for things like economy or military or society or how you get married or how you have sex or all of these things. Instead, it has a religious message. Anything that's not religious is contextual, was meant for that particular community, but those particular laws about marriage, etc., are not for our community. And therefore, the Quran should give us our religious messages, but not our political. That's different, because other moderates would say it should also give us our political message, but we just need to read that message in the right way.
Right. Well, and there is another earthquake awaiting. We understand that there were, in 1972, pages from original Qurans, or at least the oldest pages, parchment papers from a Quran, were found in a grave.
Right.
And they are being interpreted and pieced together.
Yeah, this was in 1972 in the capital city of Yemen, Sana'a. And in fact, the leaves were discovered in the roof of a mosque, because Qurans are considered to be holy objects, sometimes used as talismans. They're never thrown away, but they're stored someplace above ground. So these were stored maybe about 150, maybe even earlier, it's a big debate, but perhaps 150 years after the Prophet's death, in the roof of this mosque. And here they are, these workmen in the early 70s, tapping away at the ceiling, tap, 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 and one tap, and these parchments start floating down from the ceiling. It was a magical event. Now, it's taken about 25 years to go through all of these, and there's thousands of tiny fragments. And there was a German scholar that was leading the charge and getting these preserved and reading them, by the name of Puin, who's now in Saarbrücken, Germany. And Puin believes that these fragments are of revolutionary character. For this reason, partially, he's never been able to publish them. There's great tension in Yemen over this. In fact, the variations that we find here, I don't think will lead to such an earthquake. There are various revelations. There are chapters that are written together. There are different words that occur. But nowhere do we find a fundamental new reading of the Quran.
Much as we heard from C. Luxembourg, as
That's
you said,
right.
The interpreter in Germany.
This is a much more intriguing, exciting, and perhaps perilous movement.
Do you think in the short term, these people who are pushing for reform, will they make any headway, or are they doomed? And I mean that almost, you know, literally.
Generally, we see a great appetite for this type of scholarship in the non-Muslim world, but in the Islamic world itself, it's still risky business.
Do you fear for Mr. Shahroor, the so-called Syrian Martin Luther, who's calling for reformation?
At the same time, it should be remembered that there is a great tradition within certain boundaries in Islam, for example, of looking at different interpretations of a singular Quranic verse.
Yeah, he says his books are very popular.
And I'm sure indeed they are. There's this nice word in Arabic that is used for these possibilities. There's the word corrector. Of course, it doesn't exist in English. But I think this is correct, but I think this is more correct.
Corrector.
So within certain boundaries, there is a sense of liberty in your interpretation of it. The problem, of course, is if you cross those boundaries.
The correct est.
No, indeed.
That would be not allowed. Gabriel Saeed Reynolds, professor of theology at Notre Dame, what a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a 24-year-old American photojournalist kidnapped in Iraq is released and tells his story. Also, Scots in America, including construction workers in kilts on ladders. Think about it. More coming up Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Have you seen the email? It says that the Environmental Protection Agency plans to launch an outrageous new study in which participating low-income families will have their children exposed to toxic pesticides over the course of 2 years. For that, each family will receive $970, a video camera, a T-shirt, and a framed certificate of appreciation. In November, the Sarasota Herald Tribune cited that information in a damning editorial, adding, "The EPA should squash this idea flat." Well, is this possibly true? Let's find out. Joining us on the line, Dr. William Farland. He's EPA's Acting Deputy Assistant Administrator for Science. And welcome, Doctor, first of all.
Thank you, Robin.
And I know you've been asked quite a bit about this program, which is called CHEERS, Children's Environmental Exposure Research Study. It's planned for Duval County in Florida. Let's take the accusations one at a time. Will you be exposing children to pesticides and household chemicals?
Robin, this is a study that looks particularly at exposure to chemicals that people use in their homes.
Do they already have them in the homes?
We would be looking at individuals who have used pesticides in their homes routinely.
So even when you do this study, which, by the way, is under review, correct?
We're actually going to go through an additional review, and then we will decide on the final protocol and start the study.
Right, because you're well aware of these emails flying around, and what some of the EPA say is a misinterpretation of the study, and others say is a more careful examination of the study. But so you don't plan to be handing pesticides and household cleaning equipment to these homes if the study takes place. They will already be there. But are you going to pay the families?
We are. We are going to be compensating the families, because the way the protocol is set up, we actually will do 5 or 6 repeat visits to the same participating family over a 2-year period. We're going to spend days with them on each visit. We're going to ask them to videotape their children. And so for that, we'll be giving them between $20 and $40 a day for a full day visit.
Well, you know, there is a fear that poorer families who might not use pesticides will, so that they can receive monetary compensation and a video recorder.
That's not the way the study is designed. And certainly one of the main things that we do want to do as we go into homes and do the inventories is to be assured that the people are using the pesticides appropriately, that they are storing them appropriately. And so we'll be conveying that kind of information as well. If we find something that suggests that the pesticides are stored improperly or being used improperly, or that there are high pesticide levels, we are working with the county to actually go back and do some additional work with the families to prevent exposures. But we also recognize that these are products that are approved for use in the home, and so it will be up to the parents to make some of those kinds of decisions.
Another criticism, the American Chemistry Council has given your organization, the EPA, $2 million to fund this program. Won't the involvement of the industry responsible for making the products taint the public's perception of whatever results come from the study?
Well, I could say that I would hope that wouldn't be the case, but I know that it is a difficult issue. The cooperative agreement that we have with the American Chemistry Council is part of their long-term research initiative, and they were seeking to do a similar type of a project. So our sense and our feeling all along has been that this is an opportunity for us to get additional information on children's exposure that's going to be important to us.
Well, you know, the chemistry industry is hugely wealthy. Why doesn't the EPA require them to test these products before they come on the market?
Well, of course, the pesticide industry, just like the drug industry, has to develop a tremendous amount of information for the registration process of these chemicals. But we don't have complete information. And one of the areas that we lack information is an understanding of, frankly, human behavior at those young ages and how they might come in contact with pesticides that are used in our homes.
What are some of the concerns about the effects of pesticides and household cleaners on children?
Well, I think we've all sort of looked at the issues and the warnings that are on pesticide labels. And some of the pesticides that are used, because they are biologically active agents, by their nature they're meant to interact with biology, also can interact with the biology of human beings. And so the question is whether or not there are particular sensitivities. Now, this is not an effects study, so we're not going to be measuring effects on children, and we don't expect the exposures would be high enough to produce those kinds of effects at all.
For instance, the long-term leading to cancers or other effects?
Certainly not. Mm-hmm. And the issue that that very often is associated with some of the pesticides are much more subtle effects than that, the kinds of things that might be characterized as neurological or neurobehavioral impacts and might affect their behavior or learning and those sorts of things.
You were saying you're not looking for those long-term effects. What are you looking for?
This is an exposure study. So that the kind of work that we're going to be doing is simply to understand better the exposure that's going on in these home situations.
Yeah. How much there is.
That's right.
Well, if the study is planned to be conducted, as we read, because there are concerns about the effects of pesticides on children, isn't there another way to test while you perhaps spend that money spreading the information that there are concerns about the effects of pesticides on children?
Well, we have an office in EPA that is dedicated toward working on the issues of health protection of children. And the discussion around the proper use of pesticides and perhaps using alternative approaches when young children are present is part of the work that that office does. Now, we have to remember that there always will be a public health benefit that comes from the use of those pesticides. In this particular area, there are a lot of insects simply because of the nature of the climate and the way that the homes are built and so on. And so pesticides are used quite a bit.
And, of course, we're talking about household cleaners as well, things that people use to wash their floors that these toddlers are going to be crawling on. And I remember reading once, Doctor, that your rug in your living room right inside your front door can perhaps be one of the most dangerous areas for a toddler because people walk in and track in, for instance, all the lawn chemicals, and that's where a baby crawls around.
There certainly are some issues about transfer of chemicals from the outside or other contaminants from the outside that might get into the indoor environment where children might be exposed. And those are things that we need to know more about.
Well, Doctor, when do you think that this project might take place, and do you think you're going to be able to quell the fears of many people who, again, think that poor people are going to be lured into being guinea pigs for your test?
Robin, I think this is a very important study, and I sincerely hope that people will accept the importance of this as we move forward. We're going to be getting some advice from this independent science board over the course of the next 4 to 6 months, and by the June timeframe or so, we expect to be able to make some decisions about the final protocol for the study.
William Farland is Acting Deputy Assistant Administrator for Science at the Environmental Protection Agency. Dr. Farland, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And still to come, just how important is a slot in the Rose Bowl parade? We'll visit a New Hampshire high school band that's received an invitation 3 times. You're listening to Here and Now. Idaho caviar. You heard right, and California caviar, too. Enterprising fish farmers in the western U.S. are rapidly increasing the once minuscule domestic production of fancy fish eggs, and the timing could hardly be better because of tightening restrictions on foreign caviar imports. So just in time for the New Year's champagne and caviar celebrations, correspondent Tom Bonsi visits a fish farm and caviar store to see and taste domestic caviar firsthand.
Then let's walk on across here.
Fish breeder Leo Ray leads the way on a metal catwalk that crosses long concrete fish ponds, part of an extensive operation he owns near Hagerman in southern Idaho.
These are some of the sturgeon that are starting to get ready for caviar. These are large enough, old enough, and are cycling in developing eggs.
So these are huge fish by most people's measure.
Yes, they'll be the largest fish most people have ever seen.
The whiskered blue-gray monsters circle beneath the catwalk. These sturgeon average about 5 feet long. Ray and several of his neighbors began raising the prehistoric sturgeon for their meat more than a decade ago. Now they're just as interested in the eggs. Fish farmer Lynn Babington says the champagne wishes and caviar dreams entered the picture only recently.
The bad news is that it takes 10 to 12 years to get a caviar fish up to size. So it does take, you got to be patient to be in the sturgeon business and caviar business.
Babington sees a guilt-free treat swimming around his ponds. Producing caviar from farm-raised sturgeon can take pressure off of the dwindling wild population. Pollution, poaching, and overfishing is threatening to wipe out the world's primary source of caviar sturgeon around Asia's Caspian Sea. This fall, a United Nations agency slapped export restrictions on the entire region there. The move could hurt as much as help, warns Idaho grower Leo Ray.
The biggest problem we're going to have is to educate people that our fish is not on the endangered species list, that it is a good legal product. So many people are going to think that all caviar went on the endangered species list and quit eating it entirely.
Domestic caviar is politically correct then, but does it measure up to the imported stuff? At Seattle Caviar Company, President Betsy Shero puts out samples of wild Caspian Sea roe and some that's farm-raised from native Northwest fish.
This one is a product of aquaculture. It's from Northern California.
It'll be very similar, presumably, to what comes from Idaho.
Absolutely, absolutely. So here we go.
All right. I just got a little plastic spoonful with the caviar for the black beads, and I'm going to put it into my mouth now. Oh, that is it's smooth. Like you say, the beads kind of fall apart on your tongue. Mm-hmm. Like a good wine, it has a nice finish mm-hmm. that stays in your mouth mm-hmm. even after you've swallowed.
Now we're going to the Caspian Ocetra.
Okay. Mmm. Mmm. Now that's good.
The textural quality is wonderful. It coats the palate just beautifully.
The nutty, slightly salty flavors of the wild Ocetra caviar are a bit more complex than the farm-raised species, but all in all, the two compare quite respectably. Shero says for many connoisseurs, the choice comes down to personal preference and price. At this store, 1 ounce of domestic caviar costs $45. The comparable wild stuff goes for $78 per ounce. Idaho fish farmers hope to get in for the holidays, which is peak caviar sales season. The typical consumer buys just 1 ounce, enough for about 12 tastings.
Who knew? That report from correspondent Tom Bonsi. And taking just a second for this reminder, as always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message, 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. Hundreds of high school bands compete every year for a chance to march in the Rose Bowl parade on New Year's Day. Only a few are picked, and it's a rare thing for a band to be picked three times. But last year, the Lancers of Londonderry High School in New Hampshire won a rare third appearance in the parade. At the time, here in Auslan Menegon went to one of their rehearsals and spoke with band director Andy Susie. For this year's parade on the horizon, we thought we'd look back at what it takes to get ready.
We have 46 piccolos, we have 38 trumpets, 18 trombones, 9 sousaphones, a bass drum line, 9 snare drums. We have a clarinet line of 45, I believe, somewhere around there, saxophones. It's a good-sized band. We march the kids 9 across, and then to watch them from the banner to the last person, it's about almost 90 yards. It almost takes the length of a football field. One of the things we focus on is showmanship. And we have a lot of kids, and we cover the street, and we play a lot of music. That is a 5.5-mile parade, 2.5 hours long. We will play nonstop, really. And by the way, there are 1 million people on the streets, physically on the streets, in that 5.5 miles. And, you know, that's a lot of people to play for in one sitting. Our goal is that no one drops out, and and I'm pretty convinced that that's what's going to happen. No one's going to drop out. They're going to be on such an adrenaline high. It's painful. At the end of the parade, there will be kids in pain, great deal of pain. The last time we had a student who was a cancer survivor as a child who only had one lung, he made the whole parade, and I know that was adrenaline. And we had another student that had a fever of 102. He marched the whole thing. You get so worked up inside that no matter what it takes to accomplish this, you just do it.
Please wear Band-Aids during the parades. Please.
I'm Jackie Topper, and I'm the color guard captain for the Lancers. We do spin flags, and we're marching behind the band, and we're just basically there visual accompaniment, I guess.
So you don't march in front of them? Is the color guard always in the rear of the band?
Not always, but for Roses, because they shoot down the boulevard, you can see the flags behind the band. It works out really well.
The most difficult part of this parade is this 105-degree turn that they have at TV Corner, and that's where all the cameras are, and the Goodyear blimp, and all these news helicopters are up there shooting down on a parade, and it's very, very impressive and very intimidating because the worldwide audience is 325 million, and I can't imagine that. Some kids will probably get a little nervous, and that's okay because, there's nobody else around us. You know, we'll just do what it takes to get beyond the turn. We've done it twice before, and I feel very confident that they're going to do it again. And every other band has to do the same thing, so.
My name is Sherry Kurtzman, and I am one of the 3 drum majors of the Lancer Marching Band. We command the band. We stand in front. We conduct in front of the band.
How do you command a band?
To command a band, you have to... It's a good question. To command a band, you really have to know the people in the band. You have to somehow get the attention of all of the members and keep their attention, which is the hardest part. And absolutely, always, your eyes are with pride.
But there's 250 people behind you. They can't see your eyes.
It doesn't matter if they can. People around you, the audience can see you. Knowing that I'm representing such a great band, that just makes me keep going.
Detail, halt! Detail to the ready!
As a drum major, I wear a headphone to listen to the director telling us what to do to make sure that the band doesn't fall apart as we're marching. With the number of whistles, we'll call song 2, and we'll all blow 2 whistles, and the band will know that's the next song.
Come on, detail, action, hike! Detail to the ready! Jill, get it together, will you please? Detail, action, hike! That looks pretty casual for attention. Detail to the ready! detail, attention, hut. No snap.
There are times where he'll yell and he'll scream, but you know deep down he's really just proud of the band.
Do it again.
You got to correct them, and you have to correct them with a sense of urgency. You know, but yet you don't want to make them panic. Because if they panic, then you've lost them. You have to teach them how to believe in themselves, okay? Now, with the yelling I did, I saw improvement.
All right, this is the exercise. Just going to make turns. Forward, hard. People on the outside need to take a bigger step. Go back, reset, please. Reset.
Can I talk to you for a second? Quick second.
Yeah.
What's your name?
Stephen Morse.
And what instrument do you play?
I play a snare drum.
So now everybody's marched around in the circle and totally screwed up. I'm very tense. Are you tense? Are you nervous?
Yeah, but I know that we're going to be prepared for this. It's going to be fun, so.
People on the outside have to move. You got to start your turn quicker. Otherwise, we'll be there for way too long. Do that again.
Ready now.
Okay, go. Good job. Don't turn.
We were planning a move to do a visual in the parade, flipping the sousaphones off our bodies and then rotating them and spinning them around and stuff.
Tell me your name.
Anthony Grizzlack.
Have you ever done that before?
I just figured it out today, as a matter of fact, so.
Have you all rehearsed this?
Not at all.
How many sousaphones do you have here?
We have 8 here tonight.
Conceivably, these are like 4-foot-high instruments. You could, like, hit each other.
It's possible. We'll probably work some way to separate and make it possible.
Keep half-stepping. Don't talk right now, you guys.
So you think they're ready?
Oh, yeah, I feel very confident. They will do a nice job, absolutely, but tonight is very important for them. They have to go through this. They have to, you know, we have to challenge them a little bit, and they'll have this feeling for the rest of their lives. But the feeling of accomplishment at the end of this parade is immeasurable. It's just the greatest. It's a relief. It's a feeling of fulfillment. It's just the greatest experience, and I know that feeling, and they're going to experience that at the end of the parade. And that's when they're going to look back and say it was all worth it.
Our piece on the marching Londonderry Lancers was produced by Lynn Manigan, and we'd like to note that everything did come up roses for the Lancers in last year's parade, but like the rest of us, they'll have to watch from the sidelines this year. No band is allowed to perform 2 years in a row. Parade. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Manigan, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Will Thompson. Our newscast producers are Lindsay Crudell and Rachel Guberman. Organizing all of this, the senior producer of Here and Now, Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.